I was going to be an astronomer all through my early youth until I got to college. Then while I was in college, things on Earth began to get bad, and I decided the stars could wait for a while, that I'd better devote my tremendous abilities to, that said with a twinkle in the eye, to making things better on Earth.
On the Line, Radical Women in the Union Movement of the 1930s. Part 3 in a series of programs exploring the activities and achievements of militant women in the Great Depression.
Before I joined the party, I had no political feeling about it because I wasn't political about the women.
Folks, now here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red-hot hoochie-coocher. She was the roughest, toughest rail.
You know, but I really thought with their black jackets and their long earrings, they'd be always so serious, you know, no humor. They weren't the most attractive women in the world. I don't mean physically attractive, but they weren't anybody that I would thought that I would want to be friends with. But after I became a member of the party, I began to see where it was all at. That this was their life, and they really believed in it as sincerely as I believed in it.
Following the economic collapse of 1929, the United States saw the highest rates of unemployment ever recorded, then or since. But for those who held their jobs during the 30s, the period was also a turbulent one. More women went to work than ever before, bringing new recruits from diverse backgrounds into the fight to organize labor and improve working conditions. Alice Dodge Wolfson.
Well, when I went to Vassar, I said I was a socialist, but I really didn't know a thing about it. I just felt that was my subconscious, unconscious inclination. Then along came the Depression, and everybody began talking about world conditions and the unemployment and the situation in the country. And Norman Thomas came to speak at college, and he got up there with his imposing presence on the platform, and his wonderful voice and his lucid prose, he said exactly the things that I felt without knowing anything about it. He put my unformed thoughts into words, well documented. Well, from then on, I was his follower, and he actually influenced the rest of my life.
The post-World War I years had not been good for the American workers' movement. The strike had all but been abandoned as a tactic. Communist and socialist organizing efforts had dwindled. The new capitalism of the Roaring Twenties had overwhelmed the new unionism of the pre-World War I years. Jesse Taft Smith recalls this period.
My father was a revolutionist in Russia, and he had to leave after the 1905 revolution. Here in the United States, he was a socialist and later communist. During our times growing up in Connecticut, he worked as a machinist and a tool and die maker. He was also active in the Workman's Circle, a progressive Jewish organization. I recall reading the socialist call in our house, and I also know that my father was fired from his job in the Remington Arms Company, where he worked, because he refused to buy war bonds during World War I. From early childhood, my father taught me to love and respect the working people. He sang many songs about labor and work, and he related his revolutionary activities of his youth, his days in prison in Russia, and his work in the underground. From the time I was 11 years old, when I began to get interested in what was happening and joining up with the pioneers, my father encouraged everything I did. My mother objected to everything I did. And I guess I was about 11. I never paid any attention to anything my mother told me, and I know it broke her heart in many ways, but I just did my thing, as they say, in those days.
Not all of the women who became active in the labor movement of the 30s had had such a radical background. Loretta Zelica.
Those days you hung around, you know, it was the Depression. You hung around in cafeterias. You could sit in the docks. You could sit in Washington Square Park all night. If it was raining, you sat in Stewart's cafeteria all night, you know, the early 30s. We weren't political. We were out to have a good time.
Alice Wolfson came from a well-to-do New England family. She was already committed to socialism when she graduated from college in 1933.
And I found the Boston Women's Trade Union League, which was made up of both trade union women and intellectual women from the outside community working together to advance the cause of women workers and of the labor movement. And I decided that that was doing what I wanted to do, because I had come to the conclusion that before we could ever get anything like socialism in this country, we had to build a strong labor movement. And that view I've held ever since.
Jesse Smith's radicalism matured in the workplace.
I worked in many laundries. I started out as a packer. Later on, I was a shaker. I worked as a presser on a pressing machine. I worked as a mender and a marker and a sorter. And I also worked a tumbler. And in one laundry, they had stocking machines to dry the stockings, put the stockings over these hot metal forms. And I used to burn my hands, I remember. I had a lot of scars. My first job, I got $14 a week, and that was considered good money in those days. Later on, I worked in laundries for 24 cents an hour, 25 cents an hour, 31 cents an hour. You took whatever the boss gave you.
Loretta Zelliger held many jobs before becoming active.
I was an office worker, I was a demonstrator, I was a B-girl, I was a waitress. Oh, I even had a little agency in Stewart's Cafeteria where the drag queens, at that time the Nut Club was there, and I used to get them bookings in other clubs, and I'd lend them my clothes. They'd all give me a couple of bucks. I always made a couple of bucks. I always could pay my rent.
Prior to the 1933 passage of the National Industrial Recovery Act, there was no recognition of the workers' right to form unions. In 1930, unions represented less than 13% of the U.S. labor force, and fewer than 300,000 workers went out on strike.
One of the things that I hoped to do while I worked there was to begin to talk to the workers, to get to know the conditions, and begin to talk to the workers about the fact that what a union would do to improve the conditions in the business and in the trade. I would attend social gatherings with the workers, get to know them. I don't remember whether I really began openly to talk union yet, because if you said anything out of the way, you might find out you'd be out of a job, and you had to be very careful.
After working and seeing the lousy conditions and everything else, some of the Communist Party jargon got to me. And I said, you know, they're right. We work, and we don't get anything. Other people are getting rich off our labor. And to me, it wasn't fair. It wasn't fair. And then the conditions that we worked under were really bad. Very little safety conditions. It was very hard. But at least if I worked in the cafeterias or in the food industry and doing anything, at least I was going to eat. I had a healthy appetite. And if my friends came into the cafeteria I was working in and they didn't have any money, I used to punch their check a nickel, no matter what they ate. And half the time I have to give them the nickel.
With Roosevelt and the new Congress in 1933 came a turning point in labor organizing. The NIRA was passed in June, setting up the National Recovery Administration and giving workers the right to form unions of their own choosing and to bargain collectively. This legislation didn't cover many women workers, but it did encourage the organization of workers in industry and in the service and clerical sectors where women workers were growing in numbers.
The members of the Communist Party and the YCL who worked in the laundry industry and in the cleaning and dyeing industry got together, and we decided, in order to improve our conditions, to organize the workers into a union, because there was no union in the industry. Naturally, when we started organizing, we'd go out and give out leaflets. We called meetings of workers in their homes, because they couldn't dare to be seen talking to union people. And we succeeded in organizing the workers in many laundries. And I remember one occasion standing outside this plant, and the worker, I gave him the leaflet to join the union. He said, "Before I'll join that union, I'll kiss your ass in Macy's window." I always remember that, because about a year later, he came up with all the other workers in his shop and they joined the union.
The left itself was far from being united. Alice's work in socialist organizing had led her to join the United Office and Professional Workers Union, where rivalry between socialists and communists was intense.
At the beginning, I was elected an officer of the union. I think I was the secretary. Then we had an election, and we had two slates of candidates, although they didn't announce them as such. One was a communist slate, and one was a progressive slate. All the members of the union, I think, were either communists or socialists or something, because the office workers were very slimly organized. And we got defeated by a narrow margin. The communists differed from the socialists in a lot of ways. I can't remember the specific issues right then, but when they got into a union, they wanted to control it. They put the interests of the Communist Party ahead of all their other interests. They were building the party rather than building the union. Even if it meant destroying the union for the sake of the party, they would do it.
While business resisted the new code set up under the NRA, the labor establishment, and especially the American Federation of Labor, was only too compliant. The workers' response to these early legislative gains was increasingly militant.
And I joined the union, I think, when I was in 33 or 34, as I said. And I was working in the Fifth Avenue cafeteria, and above us were the IWW guys. I must have been a union member already then. Anyway, I was organizing that place, and the manager was going to fire me for organizing. So all the wobblies upstairs, who were upstairs, they all knew me. They used to call me the Red Rose of Washington Square. But anyway, they said, you fire her, we're going to picket this place. And I remember organizing in Stewart's one time, and I was dressed in a mini blouse and a skirt. I didn't look my age. I looked like 15 years old. And I'd go into a cafeteria and ask for a glass of milk and go to the ladies' room, drop a little stink bomb, walk out. And, of course, they'd have to empty out the cafeteria. But no one would ever suspect this nice little schoolgirl.
Of course, the NRA codes did not allow stink bombs. They did not grant the right to picket or to sit down either. Radicals revived and refined these tactics in the 30s, but labor's most effective weapon remained the strike.
We had many strikes because when the workers joined the union, the bosses would fire them. And if they fired one or two of our members, everyone would walk out and we would picket. In those days, picketing, if you picketed, you'd be arrested because it was illegal to picket. And one strike on Park Avenue, and that was the Pearl White Laundry, we were picketing there every day, and they would bring the scabs in trucks. They would pick them up at the subway station far away from the plant and bring them in trucks because the scabs were afraid of getting beaten up. And we would be picketing all the time. They always picked on the leaders, the ones the workers had elected to be their representatives, and they pushed them into the Black Mariah, the station wagon. We decided if they pick one, we're all going in. And there was one particular time we all went in the wagon and fought to get in the wagon. They tried to keep us out. We loaded up three wagons of strikers. And when we got to the court, it was in the Bronx. We were all lined up in an empty room all around the wall. And then the bosses and the police captain would come and they would start picking out the leaders and let everybody else go. Sometimes the strike was lost because the workers got hungry. We're out of work for so long. Many times we settled, or the workers had to go back one by one. We had at least 1,000 workers out on strike in 1933.
In 1934, just as some experts declared the Red Scare to be over, the economic crisis deepened, and labor's militancy hardened. 1.5 million workers struck. In 1935, membership in radical organizations was still rising.
When I joined the party, I was recruited by a good friend of mine who was on the Writers' Project. And she brings me into her unit like I was a star because I was a real worker. I was not an intellectual. I was not a writer. I was not a painter. I was not an actress. I was just a worker in a cafeteria. It was like a feather in her cap that she recruited me. Of course, I didn't stay in that unit. Had nothing in common with them, and I went into the cafeteria workers unit. I remember Roy Hudson coming down and talking to us. He was some official of the party. I don't remember his name now. But he was talking down to us because we were cafeteria workers, right? And he must have said in conclusion 900 times. So finally, I said to him, conclude already. I was bored stiff. And of course, I was disciplined. I was given, you know, good talking to for showing my disrespect. I said, well, he showed his disrespect for us. I said, I don't like being talked down to. Just because we're cafeteria workers doesn't mean that we don't have any brains, you know. We're at the point of production. He's not.
Amid fears that the New Deal would fail to stem the tide of militancy, Congress passed Robert Wagner's National Labor Relations Act in June of 1935. The new legislation reaffirmed the right of free speech to advocate unionism and to protest unfair labor practices. In setting up the National Labor Relations Board, the act recognized the government's responsibility to protect the worker. Business leaders were horrified. Rank-and-file pressure on the conservative American Federation of Labor mounted as its October 1935 convention drew near.
So I spoke to the local union. I said, I'd like to be a delegate, and since we have no money in the Treasury, make me a delegate, and I'll go at my own expense. So they said, okay. So I went, and it was a terribly exciting convention. This was the one where John L. Lewis and his industrial union supporters were all threatening to bolt the AFL.
And fine impartiality, both labor and its adversaries.
It was just before the split occurred, when the industrial unionists got out of the AFL and formed the CIO, the Committee for Industrial Organization. So at the convention, I became part of a little progressive caucus. I met quite a few people who were delegates from local, mostly delegates from local unions. There were some auto workers who hadn't yet formed the UAW, their international union. There were radio workers and other office workers. And we all got together and plotted strategy and felt that we were very influential. Well, towards the end of the convention, there was a report by the head of the Union Labor Trades Department. He was one of the old guard, a very, we thought, stuffy, elderly gentleman. And he got up and droned on in a long, long speech about how we must look for the union label on this and the union label on that. And while he was speaking, mimeographed copies of his speech were given out. And one of the members of our progressive caucus came up to me and said, you will notice there is no stenographer's union label on the copies of the speech. Why don't you get up and comment on that? Well, I, who am no public speaker, was kind of terrified at the prospect because most of the speakers were quite elderly and experienced men. But when the head of the Union Labor Trades Department finished his speech, I raised my hand timidly and rose to my feet, and I said, I am Delegate Dodge from Stenographers, Bookkeepers, Accountants, and Office Employees Union, Local 14965, and I demand to know why there is no Stenographers Union label on the copies of this speech. And, well, it brought down the house. People cheered, they laughed. Here was this young and innocent-looking lady getting up and making this demand. Well, I always, and of course the man who just made the speech made some very, he evaded the issue completely. He made a very unsatisfactory reply, naturally. So I felt that this was the last straw that brought about the split. It made me feel that I had influenced the progress of the labor movement by making this speech at the very, practically the last day of the convention. That settled the issue. From then on, John Lewis and his cohorts had completely made up their minds. And right after that, they walked out and formed the CIO.
In 1936, over 2 million workers walked out on strike.
The Orbach strike. I was sent out to pick up there. And I remember the policeman saying to me, what is a nice Irish girl like you doing on a picket line? I said, I'm not Irish. Well, he didn't believe me. He didn't arrest me. He arrested everybody else. And this happened to me another time when I was on a picket line. They didn't arrest me because they thought I was Irish. And I had to go back to the union hall feeling like a fink because they were afraid they'd think I was a spy or something because I was the only one who wasn't arrested. I remember going downtown with an umbrella full of sand in case anyone attacked me, because they had their goons. Believe me, they had their goons. And that was my protection. No one could say I was carrying a concealed weapon. I carried an umbrella full of sand, and I always carried a change purse with change in it, because if you had the change purse in your hand, you had to hit anybody. It was a good weapon, too.
The women were the mainstay of the picket line. About 80% of the picket line were the women. And they were out there, and we would march around. And to keep our spirits up, we would sing Union songs. One song we always sang was On the Picket Line. On the line, on the line, on the picket line. We'll shout and yell and fight like hell on the picket line. The songs kept the spirit going. And in the Union halls where the strikers met, we would sing songs there too.
In 1937, the number of workers on strike more than doubled to 4.5 million. The CIO took the lead in organizing industrial workers, but the new militancy spilled over into the craft sector, which had long been the province of the AFL. In the autumn of 1937, Alice Wolfson was working for the New England Council of the CIO. She recalls that labor organizers were in heavy demand.
But I was left alone in the office. And by that time, the CIO was really getting going. Everybody was rushing to get organized. The labor movement was growing by leaps and bounds, particularly the CIO part of it. People would telephone and say, we want to join a union. And it would turn out they were carpenters or something. And I'd say, well, there's a perfectly good carpenters union in the AFL. You should join that. And they said, we don't want the AFL. We want the CIO. But there was ferment all around. That's the best word I can think of to describe it. People were rushing to get organized. It was miraculous. They would come into the office every day. You didn't know who was coming in, but groups of people would come in and want help in getting organized. People would telephone constantly. They would call up and say, we've got 200 people out on the street corner. We went out on strike. What do we do now? We don't have a union. What shall we do? So I would have to rack my brains and find somebody to send around to take care of them. Luckily, there were lots of young, eager beavers around who wanted to get in on the excitement. There were young socialists and there were young Trotskyites. There were also young communists, but I avoided them. So I would find somebody to send out and sign them up and tell them about a union.
Alice was earning $30 a week with the council. For most activist women, organizing was simply a part of their other jobs.
No, I didn't get paid for this. I did it because I felt it was the right thing to do. And I really didn't expect anything great out of it. You know, it's just something I thought had to be done, so I did it. I mean, like, people needed decent housing. People needed to eat. They had to make a decent wage. They had to have a decent place to live. They had to feed their kids. They had to have shoes on their feet. And a lot of people didn't have it.
In order to go on vacation, I would have to get permission from the Communist Party club, a fraction that I was a member of. Many times I remember I asked for permission, and I was denied permission to take a vacation. I was told I was too important. The work was I was doing no one else could do. And I was a soldier, and they voted that I was not to take a vacation. I didn't take one. I just kept on doing my work. I never was too unhappy about that one way or the other. I didn't consider it a burden. I considered it something I enjoyed doing, and I got great satisfaction out of all the things I did and everything that I learned. And on weekends, there were a lot of picnics in a place called Pleasant Bay Park and Pelham Bay Park, run by different organizations. I would go there, and they would set up folk dancing, and they would sell food. The Hungarians would cook goulash, and the Italians would make spaghetti, and you'd buy the food. And the picnics were to raise money for different causes. One picnic would be raising money for the Daily Worker. There would be another picnic for the Scottsboro Boys Fund or Free Angelo Herndon. or to collect money for these veterans of the Spanish Brigade, or the struggle that was going on in Spain at that time. You'd pay admission, and they'd have raffles, and sell the food, and have dancing and entertainment. You'd have a good time.
All of the women who were active in labor organizing in the 30s recall the period fondly.
I moved into the apartment with my friend Harriet, and we had a great time. It was a basement of a brownstone, and had a fireplace, and was very cozy. And the CIO organizers used to drop around there. Now, I belonged to two unions at that time. I belonged briefly to the Newspaper Guild, but I also belonged to the, by then the office workers had an international union called the United Office and Professional Workers. We had in that a progressive group, and they used to meet in our apartment. They were socialists and Lovestoneites. Mm-hmm. I always liked the Lovestoneites. They were very nice people, and we agreed on general principles, and we were working for the same things in the union. I don't think their policy at the time was very much different from ours. I never was a theoretician. Don't ask me about nuances of political thinking, because I bogged down there.
Some do recall having had misgivings about the role of women in the movement.
I didn't feel I was fairly treated, but, you know, no matter what they say about equal rights for women, all of the big shots, and I'm talking about big shots, kept their wives in the closet. You never saw their wives at a meeting. You never saw them in an auxiliary meeting. You didn't see them at a union meeting. You didn't see them at a CP meeting. The wives were in the closets, taking care of their kids, while us poor slobs, you know, they never asked the wife to go out and organize, but if there was a big fancy dinner, ha-ha, the wives were there. But to do any damn work, no, the wives were in the closet. The women as a whole were not given a fair shake, just because they were women, because a great many women were better organizers, they were better speakers, and, you know, it was a male-dominated thing.
Even in the face of these abuses, the commitment which these women made to the struggle remains strong, as it does even to this day.
I'll never, never, never regret having been in the Communist Party. It taught me a great deal about discipline. Because when you worked for the party and you were an organizer, you had to be the best on your job. It told me to, and still am, a very good worker. The bosses always got their money's worth with me because I was a very good worker and I was conscientious. And this is something the party told me, you know. I made good friends, some of which I still have. And politics have nothing to do with our friendship now. But that's where I met them.
Well, I've had a heck of a good time, by and large. And I've met lots and lots of interesting people.
I chose what I did. I can always say my life was, it wasn't easy, but it was never dull.
Certainly, all of these women agree that there is much work left to be done. Perhaps Jessie summed it up best.
Many of the things we struggled for that people take for granted are now being threatened. People are beginning to think again. Many of my friends who I talk to from way back in the 1930s, who were sure that they would have a peaceful, secure life, not have any problems. They settled into all of our ways of living, now are beginning to feel differently. They feel more threatened. They see what's happening. And they see what's happening to the workers. And people are beginning to wake up again and think that the struggle goes on. It has to go on.
You have been listening to On the Line, part 3 of Grandma Was an Activist, a radio series on radical women in the 1930s, produced for WBAI-FM and the Oral History of the American Left at New York University's Tamiman Institute Library. Oral historians for the series, John Bloom, B. Leamish, and Ruth Prego. Project directors, Paul and Mary Jo Buell. Mix by Stephen Erickson. Our special thanks to the many interviewees and contributors who made this series possible. Grandma Was an Activist was produced by Beth Friend and Charles Potter, Radio Arts Incorporated. Your narrator is Jill Eikenberry. Grandma Was an Activist was made possible by a grant from the New York Council for the Humanities. Be sure to listen to part 4 in this series, They Shall Not Pass, Women of the Anti-Fascist Movement, over the same station.